Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the aftermath of the terrorist attack in Denmark and go to Copenhagen to speak with Flemming Rose, a journalist and the foreign editor of the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten, the daily newspaper which published 12 cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in 2005 that sparked violent protests across the Muslim world. Since Flemming Rose made the decision to publish the cartoons, we will discuss the decision to hold a public event, Art, Blasphemy and Freedom of Expression, in a Copenhagen cafe with the controversial Swedish cartoonist Lars Vilks, who also caricatured Muhammad, that provoked a terrorist attack which left a film director at the cafe and a Jewish guard at a synagogue dead. In discussing freedom versus censorship, we will look into whether restrictions should be put into place to prevent young European Muslims from being radicalized in prison, as was the case with the terrorists responsible for the recent massacres in Paris and the young Danish-born terrorist who was just released from jail 2 weeks ago. Then the world-renowned Islamic scholar Dr. Abu El-Fadl joins us in the studio to discuss the recent displays of barbarity and murder done in the name of Islam, as well as the execution-style murders of three young Muslims in America whose killing is still being attributed to a parking dispute, even though the contested parking spot was empty at the time the young students were executed by their neighbor. Dr. El-Fadl is a distinguished professor in Islamic law and chair of Islamic studies at the UCLA School of Law, who served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and on the board of directors of Human Rights Watch. His books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, The Search for Beauty in Islam, and his latest book just out is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. And joining us now from Copenhagen, Denmark, is Flemming Rose. He's a journalist and foreign editor at the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten. His latest book is The Tyranny of Silence, How One Cartoon Ignited a Global Debate on the Future of Free Speech, and he has just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flemming Rose.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly your country is somewhat traumatized by what happened in the last few days. And in many ways, Denmark is an exemplary democracy and a very tolerant place. So in terms of what happened, and of course, you were the foreign editor of the newspaper, the Danish Daily, that published the 12 cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad back in 2005. You were the culture editor, and you made the decision to publish the cartoons, and of course, they sparked protest around the world. And you've written about it in your new book, The Tyranny of Silence. So how do you see this public event that took place a couple of days ago in the Copenhagen cafe titled Arts, Blasphemy and Freedom of Expression that provoked this latest massacre?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it's terrible and it's very unusual for Denmark. I think it's the first terrorist attack since 1985 in Denmark. And even though only two people were killed, it's an event on a scale that we are not used to. I mean, we are a very peaceful country. We are we rank higher than most countries in the world on the United Nations Development Index when it comes to equality, level of education, social benefits, and so on and so forth. But we are, you know, like Europe in this difficult transition from being a multicultural, mono-ethnic, mono-religious society. We are turning into a multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multi-religious society. And we have to learn, you know, and work out rules. How do we live in peace together, side by side, with people with other backgrounds, with other religions, and with other cultures? And this culture clash or transition, you know, causes these kinds difficulties, and one of them has to do with, you know, how do you handle freedom of expression and freedom of religion in a multicultural society? Unfortunately, a lot of European politicians, on the one hand, welcome diversity when it comes to culture, ethnicity, and religion, but they think that this diversity should be met by less diversity when it comes to speech, that a multicultural society needs less freedom of expression. I, in fact, hold the opposite opinion, that it's only natural that if we welcome a multicultural society, we will also have to welcome more diverse ways of expressing ourselves. And among them, the right to criticize and even ridicule religion. That has nothing to do with racism and discrimination, because a religion is something you can choose. You're not born into a religion. It's not something that you are. And the cradle of democracy. I mean, democracy grew out of a struggle that went on for hundreds of years, a battle of ideas, where at some point in Europe we were able to make a distinction between speech and action, between the right to say something critical, even offensive, and the right not to do or commit violent crimes or doing something offensive. And we are in the midst of this process. When I decided to publish those cartoons 9 years ago, it had to do with a problem of self censorship. You know, people in cultural life were saying that we submit ourselves to self censorship when we are dealing with Islam because we are afraid what might happen to us. Other people said no, that's not the case. And we tried to find out what's the reality by inviting cartoonists to draw the Prophet as they see him. And there were basically two questions. One had to do with the fact, I mean, is there self-censorship or not? And the other one had to do with the fact, if there is self-censorship, is it based in real fear or is it just a fiction of the mind of these, artists, people in theater, museum directors, film directors, and so on and so forth. And 9 years later, unfortunately, we have to say that the answer was affirmative in both cases. Yes, there is self-censorship, and yes, it is based in real fear because people are, being killed because of making a cartoon, which I think is, the most civilized way that you can react to intimidation and violence. Cartoons do not kill people.
And again, I'm speaking with Flemming Rose, who's a journalist and foreign editor at the Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten. His latest book is The Tyranny of Silence, How One Cartoon Ignited a Global Debate on the Future of Free Speech, and he's just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. But in terms of clearly you as an individual had to deal with the backlash from making the decision to publish the cartoons that led to these explosions in the Islamic world. I think about 200 people were killed. There were attacks on Danish property throughout the world, and Danish products were boycotted in the Middle East. So I'm sure, and I know you've written about it in your new book, the extent to which you have been held liable. So how do you answer for the people who made that decision to host that public event with the Swedish cartoonist Lars Vilks that led to the shooting of the film director and subsequent shooting of the guard in front of the Jewish center in Copenhagen? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, Ian, that I stand by the decision and I do not regret it, even though I think, a cartoon is not worth a single human life, of course. But the unfortunate thing is that there are many other people who, in fact, believe that that they have a right to kill people because of a cartoon. And then the question is, how do we deal with that as a democracy? I mean, do we want to live in a fear society or in a free society? And I prefer to live in a free society. And if people are afraid, then we have to talk about it. And we have to stand up against those who are trying to intimidate the public sphere and to silence people with whom they disagree. And I think it's perfectly legitimate and within within the framework of a liberal democracy to criticize religion, even to ridicule and mock religion. I mean, ideas do not enjoy human rights. Human beings enjoy human rights. And there is an important distinction between, you know, criticizing and targeting ideas and targeting people because of who they are.
Well, it would seem to me, though, that in order to prevent these incidents from happening, particularly if you look at the similarities between the recent events in France with Charlie Hebdo and those that perpetrated it, and this 22-year-old Danish-born young criminal who was responsible for the recent massacre in...
And the perpetrators in France, they were also French-born.
They were French-born, and they were, in both cases, as far as we know, both were radicalized in prison by...
And the same goes for the Dane.
Right, and the same goes for the... I understand that. And the point I'm making here is that you have identifiable recruiters in prisons, and particularly in the case of the French, they know exactly who this fellow was that radicalized him in prison. And presumably the prison authorities tolerate that in the name of religion. So at a certain point, you would think that in order to stop these criminals becoming terrorists and having their minds poisoned by a radical version of a religion, you therefore have to censor that the preaching or the radical preachings of that religion.
Yeah, but I don't believe in that. And I you know, I spent time in the Soviet Union, and when I wrote my book, I researched the Weimar Republic, the time leading up to Hitler coming to power in Germany, and it's a widely held wrong opinion, in fact, that there was too much freedom of expression in Weimar Germany, and that's what paved the way for the Nazis, and that's why Hitler came to power. In fact, in Weimar Germany, you had hate speech laws on the books. Also protecting the Jews against hate speech. And if you take leading Nazis like Julius Streicher, the executive editor and publisher of Der Stürmer, a leading Nazi magazine, if you take Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of Hitler, if you take Theodor Fritz, one of the leading Nazi journalists, they all were convicted for hate speech. Streicher went to prison twice in the 20s, and his magazine was in fact confiscated or taken to court 36 times over the course, I think, of 11 years. So, and that didn't help. I mean, I think you fight poisonous undemocratic, racist ideas, not by banning them, but fighting them with other kinds of speech. You know, opinions do not go away just because they are banned. I mean, that's the way a dictatorship believes, that if you outlaw certain words or certain opinions, then they will disappear. But we know from history that's not the fact. You cannot eliminate a reality behind a word just by banning the word. And for instance, right now in Europe, we have a lot of Muslims who are Holocaust deniers. They don't believe that the Holocaust took place, that it was invented by the Jews. And we have many countries in Europe who have laws against Holocaust denial. Unfortunately, among them is in Denmark. And I think that's very unfortunate, because then these people will not be allowed to air their stupid and wrong opinions, and then we cannot fight them through education and confronting them in a free and open debate. So I don't think censorship helps, and I think history tells another story.
So, but short of censorship, what do you do about I mean, there have been open recruiting by radical preachers in London. The connections have been clearly made, particularly to the fellow that decapitated the British soldier in front of a military base, all caught on videotape. There's no question that the Kouachi brothers in France were radicalized by a radical Islamist, a member of Al-Qaeda, in a prison in France. And it's apparently the case of this 22-year-old Danish-born terrorist that he was radicalized. He just got out of prison 2 weeks ago by somebody in prison. So short of censorship, what do you do with about people who set these kind of guided, unguided missiles in place and literally light the fuse?
I mean, I'm not in favor of unlimited freedom of expression. I'm in favor of criminalizing incitement to violence. So if somebody in fact calls for, you know, go out and kill the Jews, then I think that person should be prosecuted in accordance with the law. I mean, I'm not an expert on radicalization, but I think in Europe we have been not that good on integration of immigrants into our societies, and among them Muslims, but it's not only Muslims. And we have to be better at that. But I don't think that you promote peace through censorship. I think you need investigative journalism. You need, you know, politicians, people in public life who have to draw these radical imams out into the public to make it clear for everybody what they are saying and doing and propagating behind closed doors in a mosque on Fridays. So they have to answer for their words. I think that's the way forward. And of course, right now in many European countries, we have these parallel societies where we have less and less of a common public space. People live in the, you know, enclaves of identity politics, and they do not communicate and debate across these cultural, religious, and ethnic lines. And I think that's very unfortunate. And we have to work and to promote these kind of interactions across religious and other lines.
Well, at a geopolitical level, though, we are quite blind, or deliberately blind, to the influence of Saudi Arabia because of the enormous amount of petrodollars over the decades that have been used to propagate a very austere and reactionary form of Islam, the Wahhabism. Mm-hmm. And as the Islamic State challenges the royal family of Saudi Arabia as the custodians of the holy shrines, that's only going to even make them more conservative in terms of their interpretation of Islam. And you just had this extraordinary pilgrimage of the President of the United States, three secretaries of states, four former national security advisors, including the current one, a whole bunch of generals, and John McCain showing up to kneel before the new Saudi king. So it seems
exactly.
To...
I agree 100%. And you know, the fact of the matter is, when it comes to the religious doctrine, there's not that much of a difference between the Islamic State and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's more or less the same ideology. Yes, Islamic State, they now are killing more people, but I mean, the way they execute people in Saudi Arabia, the way they treat women, the way they treat religious minorities, if you're bringing a Bible to Saudi Arabia, you will be arrested, is outrageous. And I totally agree. I find it very hypocritical that the people you mentioned, they are criticizing Vladimir Putin for the kind of policies he's pursuing in Ukraine, why they are, you know, they are applauding an oppressive dictator in Saudi Arabia who is spreading a violent ideology calling for violence around the world.
Well, just in closing, Fleming Rose, we had this tragic incident in North Carolina where three exemplary young Muslims were murdered by an American. We're not entirely sure about his motives, but he was certainly a typical gun-toting NRA-type American. So we don't know about how much his love of guns was involved in this. And there's a certain amount of theological confusion over his statements that he's made. But the point I would make here is that no Christian or Jew can dissuade a young Islamist who is taking a path towards radicalism. The only person that can do that is a so-called moderate Islamist. And these young people that were killed are exemplary in that sense, although I feel uncomfortable using that term because it's been so abused. But the point I would make is that we have to, surely the last thing we should be doing is alienating the very people that these young people represented. The father and much of the Islamic community in the United States is outraged about what happened. And to me, that is the most counterproductive thing that could happen. So the last thing you want to do is tar those kind of people with the broad brush of Islamic terrorism.
Absolutely, and I agree 100%. I mean, the battle for the soul of Islam is not a battle for you and me to win or lose. It's a battle that is going on among Muslims within Islam, and we can support the moderate voices and encourage them and do whatever we can to support them. But on our side, what we can do is to be clear about our own values, you know what I found over the course of those 9 years of discussing the issues of the publication of the cartoons and the reasoning behind them is that there is a deep division within the Western world about the understanding of freedom of speech and freedom of religion and what tolerance implies and so on and so forth. And that's, you know, that's for me, that's the battle I'm engaged in. I know that the battle for the way to interpret Islam is for Muslims to decide or to win or lose. And I think it's right. You're absolutely right. We have to support the moderate voices.
But then a lot of people, just in closing, would say, Muslim listeners would say, well, but why then provoke people and insult their religion, which is what the charge is against you?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. and my answer is, that in a democracy, you have many rights. You have a right to freedom of speech, to freedom of religion, to freedom of movement, freedom of assembly. You have a right to vote for different parties. But the only right you do not have in a democracy is a right not to be offended. That people from time to time may say something that you find offensive. And that that is the price we have to pay for enjoying the benefits of a democracy. Thereby, I'm not saying, you know, that you should provoke and insult people just for the sake of provoking them. But as I said in the beginning, I mean, these cartoons did not come out of, you know, of nothing. They were published and commissioned for a reason that had to do with a classical journalistic exercise. You hear about a problem, self-censorship. Is it true or not? Is it based in real fear or in fiction? And you want to find out if it's true or not. And that's why, you know, I invited cartoonists to answer not in words but in drawings. And if you look at those cartoons, they are very innocuous, and they are not that offensive. I mean, I think one of the reasons why they in your country have been perceived maybe as offensive is because nobody decided to republish them. And when you don't do that, you send the message: oh, these cartoons must be really, really offensive. But when people later got back to me and after having seen them, they said, oh, is it just that?
Well, Fleming Rose, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. And thank you for having me.
And thank you again. And I've been speaking with Fleming Rose, who is in Copenhagen, Denmark. He's a journalist and foreign editor at the Danish newspaper Jyllands Posten. His latest book is The Tyranny of Silence, How One Cartoon Ignited a Global Debate on the Future of Free Speech. And he's just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined in the studio by the world-renowned Islamic scholar, Dr. Abu El-Fadl.
Increase your pride, telling lies that you're not on your own. Watching faith in prayers will make you see.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Dr. Khalid Abu El-Fadl, a distinguished professor of Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, where he's also the chair of the Islamic Studies Program. He was named a Carnegie Scholar in Islamic Law and has served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and served on the board of directors of Human Rights Watch, among other honors. His books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, The Search for Beauty in Islam, and his latest book just out is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Khalid Abu El-Fadl.
Very nice to be with you.
And clearly we are at a moment here where so much of the potential for what was called sometime back a class of civilizations, which was in itself a kind of nonsensical notion that many conservatives in this country seized upon. But now with the killing of the three young Muslims in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, all of whom were exemplary examples of America's democracy and the extent to which there is religious freedom. In fact, one of the victims, one of the young women who was killed recently spoke on NPR about how much she loved America and how much she loved her religion. And it's unspeakably tragic. What's happening in the Middle East is unspeakably tragic, particularly the killing of the Coptic Christian workers in Libya. So for somebody that loves this country and loves Islam, this must be a painful period.
Yes, it's extremely painful, and it's a point in history where you feel madness has reigned supreme, but you really stand frozen. But it's like the worst of humanity, like the construction of hell itself. It was something that was engineered and something that was entirely avoidable, and it took a considerable amount of social engineering and cultural engineering. And by what I mean social engineering is that people who wanted and imagined this type of reality and then projected it and so strongly until it actually invented it, made it come true. And that is what is incredibly painful. I never thought that I would fondly remember the 1980s as the good old days when people used to be more rational, because the 80s were violent in their own right. But the world that we live in today is a world that is quite trying, quite trying.
Well, it would seem to me that, are you suggesting, though, Dr. Khalid Abu El-Fadl, that there is a kind of symbiosis between right-wing xenophobes in the West and these xenophobes, for example, the Islamic State? Because in many ways, I don't see so much difference between the so-called theology of the Islamic State and the theology of Saudi Arabia. And it would seem to me that the more the Saudis feel threatened by this new so-called caliphate, won't that have the political dynamic of making the Saudis even more conservative? Because the al-Baghdadi is claiming to be the legitimate caliph, if you will, the custodian of the holy shrines, and challenging directly the Saudis. So this is not going to have a moderating effect on them, surely. I guess that's my point.
No, it will not. And after the death of the most recent king, there has been some major changes and shifts within Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's quite a sad story, but ISIS itself was yet another manufactured reality. First, we have to remember that all of this started with various societies, various countries, millions of people, their dream of living in freedom. And all the demonstrations that went out in what we call the Arab Spring, nonviolent, the slogans were all about wanting end to despotism, end to corruption and social injustice. These various revolutions that extended through a very large area of the Arab world were suppressed and derailed and preempted in a variety of ways that were heartbreaking. But essential to the destruction of all these revolutions was a key component, a central idea that moderate, and it's a notion that we could talk about, that political Islam is by definition immoderate, not moderate, that political Islam, in the sense here, political Islam, Muslims who want to be faithful Muslims and yet still interested in political issues such as living in a democracy, such as wanting an end to corruption, or such as wanting a sense of national dignity. When you define political Islam in these very broad terms and you go out in an all-out war against it, the net result was once you've snuffed out the moderate option, you've only left space for extremism, and that was the birth of ISIS. But I also want to add here that ISIS was, and it took me a considerable amount of time before I feel now absolutely comfortable saying this, that ISIS was manufactured by intelligence agencies. Bandar bin Sultan played a huge role in the creation of ISIS. When the idea...
And he's the former Saudi defense minister.
Right.
Who just got fired, yeah.
He got fired because of his miscalculation regarding the role that ISIS played. He believed that the creation of ISIS and the funding of ISIS and all of that would, one, get the West on board in opposing all types of Islamist symbolism, talk, in demonizing the Islamic construct in all its forms, and get the U.S. interested in on board in opposing all the, let's say, liberal programs of the Arab Spring in its many manifestations. And he thought that ISIS would play a very good role as a boogeyman. As has happened in the past in history, the boogeyman doesn't usually behave itself. The boogeyman is truly insane and will kill others and you. And once ISIS started threatening getting completely out of control and so on, a condition that the U.S. placed for becoming involved in bombing ISIS locations was that Bandar becomes a persona non grata. In other words, that, okay, this is a major screw-up. If you want us to get involved in the fight against ISIS, this is such a miscalculation that, you know, Bandar bin Sultan has to get out of the picture. And that's exactly what happened. He was fired. But the further development is that within the Saudi government, there was a key figure called the Tuwaisiri, who was close advisor to the previous king. And Tuwaisiri played a key role in engineering the alliance with Sisi, with the alliance with sort of the
counter-revolutionaries.
Yeah, the counter-revolutionary movement
of the Arab Spring, right?
Of the Arab Spring, and his vision was consistent with the idea that we use radical Islam as a boogeyman and use that as stabilizing, legitimizing means to anchor despotism and the old system. Tuwaijiri has been fired, and the firing of Tuwaijiri, and now that he's been become a persona non grata himself, seems to indicate that that's all the various the evidence points to, is that Saudi Arabia has realized, or the policy, that they need to convince the Muslim world that they're pious and that they represent mainstream Islam again. That sort of the role that they played, in which they are being counter-revolutionaries and being associated with radicalism, but allowing mainstream Islam to produce the Arab Spring, is an error. And I expect that Saudi Arabia will double its efforts in getting rid of the type of Islam that challenges rulers, but that focuses on pedantic social and cultural issues. So it's a quietist, legitimist sort of Islam, not concerned with social issues or political issues, but solely concerned with cultural issues such as the control of women and xenophobia and things like that.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Khalid Abu El Fadl, a distinguished professor in Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, where he's also the chair of the Islamic Studies Program. He was named a Carnegie Scholar in Islamic Law and has served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and served on the board of directors of Human Rights Watch. And his books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, The Search for Beauty in Islam, and his latest book just out is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. So in terms of what you've just told us about Saudi Arabia, and of course I'm sure you noticed the pilgrimage of the American national security elite, a president, a sitting president, three secretaries of state, four national security advisors, John McCain, Obama's rival in 2008, and a whole bunch of generals all sort of kneeling before the new king. And the Saudis, of course, are lowering the price of oil as in effect, yeah, killing the American fracking revolution and taking over the market. So what was your sense of the deal? What was the deal there? I mean, obviously, the lowering price of oil helps Obama, but it doesn't help the oil companies, does it?
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. And this sort of – I see the oil games. I mean, the sort of – these market games – it's sort of like a game of risk or a game of some type of friendly strategic flirting among the elites. I mean, it's as you get to know each other, you say, "I'll make you richer, a couple of $1 billion," and then as you you disagree on certain issues, you say, "Well, I'll take $1 billion from you." But this is all change among the elites of both countries. But what was quite clear and fascinating is that the elite of the United States went again to make sure that the new government, the new king and his men, are going to sustain and maintain the basics. The basics is the preservation of all secret and not non-secret or badly kept secrets, U.S. bases in strategic areas in the Gulf region, especially Saudi Arabia, that the various agreements that they have that allow oil to be used as, or allow the not using oil as a political instrument to further anti-imperialist or anti-colonial or pro-Islamic policies in ways that affect the economic interests of, and quite frankly, the West. But quite frankly, I don't think our elites, they are upset when Saudi Arabia creates a boogeyman like ISIS that requires a military involvement that, and that itself, as I say it, I'm hesitating because I, in many ways, ISIS serves the interests of so many elites in the United States. A lot of the fanatics in the U.S., ISIS is a dream come true, as 9/11 was a dream come true, and I do not believe that these types of coincidences just occur as unintentional windfalls in their lap. But what they do, and, but I do not believe that their primary concern, or that they even at all mind Saudi Arabia aggressively controlling the pulse of Islam in the same evangelical manner that it did in the 90s and in the 80s. In other words, in fact, by controlling Islam in this fashion, it made this energy and the spiritual power of this great faith as if it yielded it into a tool in the hands of policymakers in Saudi Arabia. And so it's when you've got a country that can act as a proxy for you and turn the spiritual energy of an old faith like Islam into an instrument in their hands, and so it directs it in one way or another way, depending on fleeting and material interests. That's a great thing that elites covet, and I believe that the part of this pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia was to make sure that our rather imperialist policies are all going to be a status quo and so on. But two is to get a sense of what Saudi Arabia wants to do with managing the affairs of Islam, and that critical role in preempting killing off what they call political Islam, which means Islam concerned with justice, Islam concerned with social equity, Islam concerned with non-despotism, all forms of Islam that humanistic Islam has also been tagged as political Islam. In other words, Islam as a living humanistic force is something that Saudi Arabia has carefully in the past made sure to neutralize. And I fear that now Saudi Arabia will aggressively act to neutralize again.
Well, let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment and continue the conversation with Dr. Khalid Abu Al Fadl about his new book, Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who's a distinguished professor of Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and his latest book just out is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. And in terms of The Great Theft, we have actually been talking about The Great Theft, clearly. And there have been other earlier thefts as well, in the sense that this great religion has been made less humane and more controlled. And, you know, it's no accident that the radicals, the ones that the Prince Sultan unleashed on us, the first people they go after are the Sufis. You know, so how do you reverse this? I mean, there's nothing more tragic than these, as I mentioned in the opening, than the death of these three exemplary young Muslim Americans in North Carolina. And you know, you hate to see that kind of poisoning of the debate continuing and things becoming more polarized, and the outrage that the families felt about how Muslims are scapegoated and always assumed to be terrorists in this country, that's all, you know, playing right into the hands of the Wahhabis and the Islamic State, and of course, which is neither a state nor Islam.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things that are really critical here. Is that I think a good part of my life has been expended working in the field of human rights. And one of the true tragedies is that the dream of establishing the normative values of human rights as a universal truth for humanity has gotten further and further away. And a key component, a key reason for the evaporation of that dream is that what I believe are people with, whether they realize it or not, genocidal agendas who believe that the world is divided into civilizations, and these civilizations inevitably will clash, and so on and so forth. And the problem is that a lot of in the West, a lot of these people are in elite places, and so they have a direct line of influence to policymakers. And in the Islamic world especially, a lot of the same types are either sufficiently narcissistic and self-involved that they will simply play, do whatever the West tells them, or they are within the very ruling financial elites of the world. And so the emergence of the Islamophobic discourse, which is every bit as ugly and insane as the fanatic Islamic discourse. I mean, it is truly amazing if you translate the Islamic fanatic discourse, just remove, instead of Jews and Christians, you put Islamic. In other words, if you just get tweaked it a little so it sounds more Christian, it's identical. The notion of that the A people on both sides are, by their nature, liars and not truth speakers and incapable of being truthful. The idea that on both sides that they are full of conspiracies and hidden agendas and you can't trust anything they do or say, et cetera, et cetera. What I really think is critical for any moral human beings to realize is that we are living in a genocidal atmosphere. I never thought that I would say this in the United States, because I always thought the United States, even quite distinct and separate from France, for instance, where I did feel genuinely scared in my visits to France, but the United States, I always thought that genocidal atmosphere is not possible because there are many moral and level-headed people, and that they outweigh the crazies. Unfortunately, I'm not so sure anymore. Just the way the treatment of these three that were murdered in North Carolina and the attempt to spin it as a dispute about parking, and the way that the media has sort of wanted to ignore it, and the way that there is a consistent understating of crimes against American Muslims as if they are the fact that they're Muslim makes them less American or less human is truly terrifying. And I'm not sure how to reverse this increasingly...
Well, it's this poisonous symbiosis that you're talking about, isn't it? It's happening on both sides, in effect. They're mirroring it the worst of each other, and that's the dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're both inventing an enemy that is truly hateful, and they're going off to fight the truly hateful enemy exists only in the shadows and in the darkest areas and in the nooks and crannies. I mean, it's sort of like you're chasing vampires and right. monsters in the dark and so on. But when I wrote The Great Theft, I mean, I wrote it trying to inform what was then rather an original idea, is that I realized the hijacking of Islam and I. At the time that I, before even the Great Theft, at the time that I talked about the hijacking of Islam by Wahhabis, the idea was still not widespread and not common, and I thought that it was an essential message for both Muslims and non-Muslims, for Muslims to realize that this is happening to their religion and to play an active role in resisting it. And for non-Muslims to understand that they are being a part of the problem when they legitimate this hijacking by saying, yes, the hijacker's construction of Islam shows us the real religion. It's sort of the same thing as when some idiot wrote an article saying that ISIS is the true Islam. I'm not going to name him because he's a prominent idiot.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of them. So let me turn to your new book there, because Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. And just in terms of what's happening at the moment with what happened in North Carolina, and of course it's worth noting that for all of this nonsense about it being a parking dispute, the very parking spot that was in dispute was empty at the moment these young kids were killed.
Right.
So, it's let's get real here.
Yeah.
What this is about. But how do you tell non-Muslims, or how do you, without short of converting somebody, which of course is the worst possible answer here, how do you tell people that this is a beautiful and non-threatening religion and that those that experience it understand it, but those that don't, and that's just obviously inherently the problem.
Well, reasoning with God, I mean, even as the title reflects, whether it's a Muslim or a non-Muslim, and in fact, one of the greatest acts of virtue is to feed and shelter prisoners of war. In Sharia, and we grew up, I remember that Western neighbors, we had some neighbors from France and some neighbors from the U.S. later on in our life, and they used to find it bizarre how generous and Arabs are towards foreigners, towards strangers, that we'd, this idea of beti beta, your home is my home, so the same expression exists. And anyway, but I reflect, I'm reflecting on the fact that how much we were raised with this notion that being kind to the stranger, being kind to the person who is away from their home is fundamental and basic to what makes God pleased with us. This is the essence. This is the Sharia that allowed Islam to become with a billion more than a billion 0.6 or whatever it is followers. This is the Islam that, although the region goes through while leaders are fighting their wars and combating over power, the predominant form of Islam for centuries was, well, you know, would fall under the label of Sufism. Some of the most remarkable articulations of beauty and poetry and love, whereby leading Muslim spiritualists. And the process of reasoning with God is to try to figure out, for my own salvation, is what type of God exactly I worship? Is it that God that Rumi and Hafiz, and who Rumi, by the way, was a Muslim religious scholar, contrary to what a lot of people try to make him, they try to de-Islamize him. Did they have the right conception of what Allah is, what God is, or is it the Bin Ladens of the world? And it's not. Unlike the Great Theft, it's not primarily concerned with sort of the politics of things, but it is primarily concerned with the humanism of things. Where are we heading as human beings? If God is going to be a part of our future as human beings, how do we need this relationship to be? How must this relationship be? Otherwise, as a person of faith, I cannot believe in a God that would be a co-conspirator in any genocidal project. And what we are doing is that we are, in fact, inventing a God that would be a partner in a genocidal future, and that is, there's nothing that we need to fight against as much as that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in the studio. You're quite welcome. Dr. Khalid Abu Al-Fadl is a distinguished professor in Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law. He's also chairs the Islamic Studies Program and was named a Carnegie Scholar in Islamic Law and has served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and served on the Board of Directors of Human Rights Watch. His books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, The Search for Beauty in Islam, and his latest book just out is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.